Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else, the Iditarod, and finishing the Iditarod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media. That was Chad Stoddard at the very beginning of this Iditapod in a clip courtesy of Iditarod.com, arriving at the Burled Arch finish line in Nome at the end of 1,000 miles of the Iditarod Trail in 7th place. Yes, that's right. And it's 16 places higher than last year for Stoddard. That was his rookie run, but on a shorter pandemic-altered Iditarod, which didn't even go to Nome. I would guess Chad Stoddard will get the Most Improved Musher Award this year, but the race still isn't over for a couple dozen mushers at the moment, and I believe that award is one that Iditarod finishers vote on, so we will see. When I said at the moment, for me, that's Wednesday, and since our last episode with Brent Sass winning his first Iditarod championship, holding off five-time champ Dallas Seavey down to the wire, we saw, overnight, by the time I got up this morning, the rest of the top 10 finish. We're going to talk more about them, including closer looks at Jesse Holmes and Dan Caduce in third and fourth, respectively, both from the Yukon-Kuskokwim region, into Nome in fifth and sixth. Like I said, then we had Chad Stoddard in 7th, Aaron Burmeister, the Nome Town guy, in 8th. We'll hear from him. Then there's the grandson of the Iditarod, Ryan Reddington, in 9th, and Alberta's Aaron Peck with his highest finish in 8 tries at 10th place. We'll also have a superstar of a dog of the day and a listener question, of course. So now that I've promised all of that, let's go back to Brent Sass for just a minute. Or 2 minutes, because that's almost exactly how long this next story is. I know, because I was desperately trying to squeeze it into one of those morning modules this morning. We talked in our last episode about watching Sass's team struggle in the howling wind on a notorious stretch of the coast, mushing the final miles to the finish line. As Sass was heading from White Mountain on the final 77 miles to Nome overnight Monday into Tuesday morning, everybody was watching the race GPS tracker on the edge of their seats. I know I was. That's because it was showing Sass stop at least twice, with a total stoppage time of about an hour on those runs. And of course, right behind Sass, only about 2.5 hours out of White Mountain, was his pursuer, Dallas Seavey, who we could see was gaining on Sass. So what happened out there? Well, Sass told a group of reporters gathered at the Nome Nugget newspaper office later Tuesday, that's just actually right down Front Street from the finish line, he filled us in on the full story. Sass said he was driving his sled over the Topcock Hills outside of Nome, getting blasted by wind of at least 50 miles per hour. Then a big gust pushed him off the trail and his sled, which had a broken runner affecting his ability to steer, and they all started to slide down the side of a hill.
We just tumbled down off the trail into the abyss. I mean, I can show you a video of what it looked like when we got down off the trail. We weren't very far, but the problem is that I went, and then all the dogs got drugged down with me. So now the dogs and I are just in a big pile, not very far off the trail, I hope. Like, you have no bearing on how far you've gone because you can't see anything.
Remember, this was in the wee hours of the morning, and even as we're gaining daylight in the springtime here in Alaska, it was still very dark, and there was snow blowing everywhere. Sass, who talked to Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan, shared some video footage with Lex of the entire ordeal, which is posted now at alaskapublic.org if you want to see it. But here is what that sounded like. After sliding off the trail, Sass said the dogs immediately laid down, and within seconds they were tangled up and covered with snow. He lit a headlamp on his sled so he wouldn't lose the sled, and then he marched back up the hill to find the trail, which you can see him looking for it in the video at one point, and just kind of looking around, you don't see a trail. The snow, when he looks directly into the wind, looks like the special effects in a movie of stars zipping by when, you know, the spaceship goes into warp speed. That blowing snow quickly formed into drifts around the dogs, which a lot of the time sled dogs are fine with, but not when they're tired and confused like they were at the end of this 1,000-mile race. In the video, they're mostly all curled up, looking like, nope, we're not getting up to go anywhere. One dog has its head resting on the sled, just like your dog at home might do on your lap if you were sitting on the couch. Sass, of course, was not taking this sitting down, but he did say after the race he thought about hunkering down for a while and, quote, letting the cards fall where they may. So it sounds like even he didn't know what was going to happen, although he did make it happen by getting to the finish line first. Out there still on the trail, though, that morning, an Iditarod media crew came by on a snow machine and offered him help, something mushers have definitely accepted in the past to save themselves and their dogs. But Sass declined because it would have meant disqualification.
It wasn't a life or death or survival thing. It was beating Dallas Seavey. Like, that's all that mattered at that point.
Sass pulled his dogs out of the snowdrifts that had formed around them, lined them up, and started pushing the sled back up the trail. And then miraculously, he said, they all started to pull again. They had one more brief stop, but the dogs ended up pulling him all the rest of the way to Nome, finishing ahead of Dallas Seavey by a little more than an hour. So that 2.5 hours out of White Mountain got cut in half. Our guy Lex, still out in Nome, has a much longer interview with Brent Sass that he recorded, and we'll be posting that as an extended clip and a bonus episode here on the Iditapod. But it really was a very exciting finish watching that with those two so close together. Sometimes the musher out of White Mountain, again, where they take a mandatory 8-hour break and get rested up for the final push, if they're pretty far ahead and then they have smooth runs all the way to Nome, it's almost just a formality when they actually cross the finish line. Over 1,000 miles and 8 days plus of racing, that 1 hour, 8 minute, 8 second difference between Sass and Seavey really is considered a close finish, but I have to note, it's not close to being the closest finish. Back in 1978, Dick Mackey and Rick Swenson raced each other down Front Street to finish just 1 second apart, with Mackey winning when his lead dog's nose crossed the finish line. In another legendary move, in 2008, Dick's son Lance Mackey had just a 3-minute lead on Jeff King into Elim, about 150 miles from Nome. But Mackey pretended like he was going to take a nap. He had sneakily left his boots outside a building where mushers were able to rest at that checkpoint. So King thought it was going to be safe for him to take a nap too, and because Mackey's boots were outside, he was able to get away without waking King up. And then Lance Mackey turned that 3-minute lead into a gap of about an hour and, of course, won the race. So a different Mackey had won the closest Iditarod finish, and Jeff King was actually involved in the second closest finish, although he didn't actually mush all the way to Nome that year. It was 2014, and he had an hour lead out of White Mountain, so it was looking like he was going to win the race. But then, in the last 20 miles or so, not far from where Brent Sass had trouble, the wind also blew King's team around, and it was so bad that he did accept help from some snow machiners just for the safety of his dogs and himself to get them out of there. Allie Zirkel was mushing behind King, but she paused in the aptly named checkpoint of safety, got passed by Dallas Seavey, and then she finished behind Dallas only 2 minutes later in Nome. That is just incredibly close when you think about all of the little mishaps over the course of a race that each by themselves might take up a couple of minutes at least. And we heard about some of those in a previous story. They were definitely longer than 2 minutes. So over 8+ days, it's just bonkers to think about finishing only 2 minutes behind the person in front of you. So while the short time between Sass and Seavey this year is notable, it's definitely exciting to watch in the moment, possibly, you know, one of the closest anyway. You don't have to go back very far, really, to find a closer finish than that. In 2019, even Pete Kaiser beat his buddy Yor Lifseth Olsen by just about 12 minutes. One really neat thing this year was that something like 13 hours after Sass and Seavey finished, with that much bigger gap between them and the rest of the field, Sass returned to the finish line to see the rest of the top 10 arrive in Nome. Just hanging around there like another race fan. Here he is talking to Iditarod Insider about why he did that and joking at first about how really he should have just gone to sleep.
I'm doing a little bit of that in and out, but it's just fun to see all the dog teams come in, as many as I can be up for. You know, so far I've got all 9 of the the finishers, so, or 8 of the other finishers. So yeah, it's just fun to be here and congratulate everybody and watch dog teams, right? I don't get to see other dog teams very often during the year, so it's fun to come down and say hi to everybody.
Is there a little something special to do this as a champion?
Yeah, I think it also says a lot. I mean, I think it's good for the sport. I think it's good for the race to have the current champion come down and just be here and congratulate everybody when they come in. As many as, like, I'm not going to make it to them all, I'll admit right now, but I'm going to make it to as many as I possibly can over the next few days.
Yeah, kind of says something. It's more than just a competition.
Yeah, it's way more than a competition. I think that's one of the greatest parts about mushing is that it's a family, you know. We're all friends behind the competition and behind everything. We're all friends. We all go through the same struggles, and we, you know, being with animals and having dogs is a unique thing. I think we all share that, and we can come out and compete and also be friends at the same time.
Well, part of that top 10, of course, were this year's third and fourth place mushers who were set up for an even closer duel than Sass and Seavey at the end. Those next two to finish were Jesse Holmes and Dan Caduce, and they were only 16 minutes apart out of White Mountain. When they reached Nome Tuesday night, both mushers had claimed the best finishes of their careers. As Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, they both had fast teams, but different strategies along the way.
The crowds are smaller than they were for the top two finishers on Front Street in Nome as the sun begins to set over the Bering Sea. But the race for third place between Dan Caduce and Jesse Holmes is even tighter than the nail biter for the Iditarod Championship. The Nome police sirens ring out to announce a dog team on the road about a quarter mile from the finish. It's Jesse Holmes, the musher who lives in Brushkana outside of Cantwell. Holmes is pulled by 9 dogs. His red beard is frosty, and he's wearing glacier sunglasses that wrap around the side of his face to protect from the sun's glare. Holmes is pretty excited to finish in third place, something he attributes to his conservative racing strategy.
I mean, that's an old saying in racing that I've heard, you know, you race like you're going to be in the top 20 and you'll end up in the top 10. So I guess we applied it a little bit further.
He was at the back of the top 10 until about halfway through the race when he exploded with fast run times between checkpoints down the Yukon River. His personal best finish almost didn't happen after a group of teams chasing leaders Brent Sass and Dallas Seavey got stuck in a storm in Shaktulik. Locals told Holmes and others that the 50-mile-per-hour winds on the next leg across the unprotected Norton Sound would be suicidal. A half dozen mushers bedded down for the night. In the morning when the storm subsided, they didn't wake up Holmes.
Yeah, everybody ditched me. They kind of got out of there early. And we were all supposed to go together, but... Right.
His speedy team managed to catch and pass the teams that had left Shaktulik before him, and he arrived in White Mountain checkpoint with a narrow lead over Caduce. Caduce wasn't able to close the gap on the way to Nome. About a half an hour after Holmes, Caduce arrives at the finish line, lifting his hands in triumph despite narrowly missing the podium. After a gear check and a mandatory nasal COVID swab at the finish, he explains he also had a late start leaving Shaktulik after the storm had eased. He saw a musher preparing to brave the ice and got ready to follow.
I just started getting ready and left. And actually a few mushers got out before me, but the speed that we had at that point really did us some favors.
Caduce's speed was a result of an even more conservative racing strategy than Holmes. He lingered around 20th place, a third of the way through the race, but unlike Holmes, Caduce arrived with 14 dogs he started the race with in harness. No other musher in the Iditarod is still running with their full team of dogs. Many racers, including Holmes, dropped some slower dogs towards the end of the race in favor of higher end speed. Caduce can't say exactly why he chose to keep them all instead of shooting for third place.
I don't know. It's not something that happens that often that somebody, you know, in a really competitive spot brings a full strength.
He says even though he missed a top 3 spot, it still feels pretty dang good to PR by a big margin. His next best result was 16th place last year. Plus, he gets to celebrate the finish with all 14 of his dogs. Reporting on the Iditarod Trail in Nome, I'm Lex Trinan.
When Lex says PR there a little bit ago, he of course meant personal record, not public relations or whatever else PR might stand for. The fifth place Iditarod finisher Peter Kaiser of Bethel actually came into Nome about 6 hours faster than his championship run in 2019. And then Richie Deal tied his best finish, placing sixth. Deal's from Aniak, up the Kuskokwim River from Bethel, out in western Alaska, so Kaiser and Deal know each other pretty well. Finishing in the top 10 together and mushing so close to each other for a ways, that really must have been fun for those two, although competing against each other. They actually passed each other several times between White Mountain and Nome, and Kaiser just barely getting the best of Deal on this one. They're definitely a couple of hometown favorites in the YK Delta, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And the news director for KYUK, that's our Alaska Public Radio Network member station out there in Bethel, she flew up to Nome to see Kaiser and Deal finish. Her name is Anna Rose MacArthur, and she has this story.
Pete Kaiser arrived across the Iditarod finish line in fifth place at 9:45 p.m. Family and friends from Anchorage, Aniak, and his hometown of Bethel crowded beneath the famed Burled Arch to welcome him. Kaiser walked down the line of his nine dogs, rubbing each of their faces. Esteemed former Iditarod racer Dee Dee Jonro pressed her face to the dogs' snouts, telling them hello. Meanwhile, Kaiser's father, Ron, fed the dogs raw meat.
Stew meat.
Pete Kaiser, 9 days, 6 hours, 45 minutes, and 15 seconds. Congratulations.
Then Iditarod race marshal Mark Nordman made an announcement.
I wanted to let everybody know that Pete carried a little bit of cargo this year.
The family of Dick Wilmarth, the first Iditarod winner, had asked Kaiser to carry his ashes down the trail along with his trading card. Wilmarth was from the Middle Kuskokwim River community of Red Devil and died in 2018.
A total honor to do that. Obviously, he's from the Kuskokwim River, just like I am, and we're both Iditarod winners. He was the first Iditarod winner. This is the 50th anniversary, so pretty special to have him ride with me in the sled down the trail.
Kaiser won the race in 2019. He said the large crowd of YK Delta fans who flew in made this finish feel like he'd won again. Then a physician administered Kaiser's final nasal swab COVID test of the trail. He described that trail as hard-packed, icy, and consistent, which made for easy pooling. He said his run-rest schedule was also consistent. With many young dogs on his team, he said this predictability would build trust with them. And if he could maintain that schedule through the race, it would appear laid back at first and then more aggressive along the coast. Kaiser's strategy worked. He ranked around 14th position for much of the race. Then, when he hit the coast, he passed one team after another, jumping up the standings. In the final stretch, he overtook Aniak musher Richie Deal. Kaiser said the race changed his team.
They're totally different dogs now. They're going to go home and feel like, you know, they're Superman. And so, yeah, they'll be full of confidence now after this.
Richie Deal arrived 17 minutes after Kaiser at 10:02 p.m. in sixth place. The same family and friends that had welcomed Kaiser also welcomed Deal. They're his family and friends, too.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Richie Deal.
Deal finished with eight dogs. Only one of them had finished in Nome before. Like Kaiser, Deal said he's ending with a stronger team than he started with.
We battled some pretty good storms along the coast, and so, I mean, they got to see the best of it, so I think they'll be good in the future.
He credited his lead dog, Bruiser, to helping the team make it through those storms. Another dog, Jimbo, was sent back to Anchorage early in the race. Jimbo escaped the Iditarod dog lot and was found a day later. Deal thanked everyone who helped look for him.
Thank you.
At the Iditarod finish line in Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
I'm definitely not used to hearing Anna Rose sign off from Nome. Usually it's Bethel or somewhere out in western Alaska. So pretty cool to hear that. And just one of the hardworking public radio reporters that we have sprinkled across all of Alaska. Okay, so Anna Rose MacArthur there getting us caught up with fifth and sixth place. Then we have the aforementioned Chad Stoddard, who arrived in seventh. Although I have not done a full analysis, he is my best bet for most improved musher this year. Here's Stoddard at the finish line, courtesy of Iditarod.com.
I knew I would make it. Alaska. Just didn't know how it would work out.
Always got to believe. That's
what it all starts with.
At the end of that clip there, you hear that another musher is approaching. That's Aaron Burmeister, who we'll get to in a minute, finishing just 7 minutes behind Stoddard. Stoddard, by the way, passed Burmeister about halfway between safety and Nome, so somewhere around 10 miles from the finish, he was able to claim that seventh place. Stoddard was mushing Dallas Seavey's B team. I think in his rookie run had been racing some dogs from Lance Mackey. And those B teams, again, they're usually the younger, up-and-coming dogs. Although with Seavey, it sounds like he's going to step away from mushing the Iditarod for a while after this year. Unclear what those B team dogs will be doing next year. And I guess we'll just have to see if that elusive sixth most winningest championship will entice him back. I have a feeling we're going to see Dallas Seavey back in the Iditarod. He's still relatively young, so. Stoddard's jump up the ranks 16 positions from last year, that got me thinking, who is the most improved of the most improved mushers? Well, there have been some very improved mushers over the now 50 Iditarods, but the most improved of the most improved comes down to a tie. That would be a jump of 46 positions, a feat that's actually been achieved twice. First by musher Linda Plettner, who finished in 66th place in the 2000 Iditarod, and then finished all the way up in 20th in 2002. Matthew Fahler also won most improved musher by going from 59th to 13th in back-to-back Iditarods, 2017 to 2018. Just a little Iditarod trivia there, and I have a feeling Chad Stoddard will be joining that list. Another storyline in this year's race brings us to Aaron Burmeister, who grew up in Nome watching the Iditarod finish there and has had a kennel on the road system in Nenana, south of Fairbanks, for a number of years. He has said, like Dallas Seavey, that he wants to step away from competitive mushing to spend more time with his family. Burmeister got emotional talking about that in a clip in an earlier episode, saying that during the races, and this is his 21st Iditarod, he always thinks about how he's going to improve for the next year, but that it had been tough remembering that he's not planning on being in the Iditarod the next go-around. So when he was talking about that earlier and getting emotional, that was in Unalakleet, and by the time Burmeister had mushed the final quarter of the race and gotten to Nome, he didn't seem so wistful about it anymore. I wonder why. Probably because taking an extended break sounded great to him right at that moment. That's just a guess. I can't get inside his head. And I'm sure he was feeling some pretty strong emotions at the finish line there. But here's Aaron Burmeister himself at the finish in Nome, courtesy of Iditarod.com.
I got to thank everybody for coming out tonight. It was all vehicles from Farley's Camp home. It's the most amazing homecoming to come to the finish and have everybody come out for you and see everybody. And not just here in Nome, I miss everybody and it's awesome to be here, but every village along the trail. It was people coming out just out of the woodwork to say hello and visit along the way. And it's one of the things that makes this race special. Iditarod represents a lot to not just the mushers and not just the volunteers, but to the state of Alaska and the people. And that's what makes it the Iditarod. It's larger than life, and it's a real special experience.
So what's next?
Next is a hot shower. I think I worked harder this year than I've worked in 20 Iditarods to get here.
Aaron Burmeister there, back home in Nome, always a thoughtful, well-spoken guy. Not sure if you can hear it fully at the end of that clip, but he got his daughter to jump on the sled runners to help him park the team, and then the dogs took off with a big jolt, so they both had to really hang on, and they did. They stayed on the sled. As it turns out, it's a dog in that team, Burmeister's team, that is our dog of the day. He's a big boy, but I'm still going to try to just shoehorn him right in here. His name is Franklin. Here is Aaron Burmeister again.
Franklin's a big dark male. He's 70 pounds, and he's just a beautiful dog. Everything he does is effortless for him, and he's 5 years old this year. This is his third Iditarod, and he's got a very unique personality. He's happy-go-lucky. He wants to please, and he's a really special dog all the way around.
And you call him the Michael Jordan of sled dogs. Why do you call him that?
It just because he's such an athletic dog. He's a super dog. Just with his athleticism and his character, his personality, he's a cheerleader for the rest of the team. He's driving the rest of the team all the time. He wants to see everybody at their highest potential. And he'll talk to them. If somebody's backing off, he'll start talking to them on the trail.
And what position does he run?
He runs lead and in the team.
Franklin, the Michael Jordan of sled dogs, and Aaron Burmeister there with our Lex Trinan. As with all of our dogs of the day, you can find a photo of Franklin at alaskapublic.org. You can also tell that Burmeister, at the age of 46, is from a slightly older pre-LeBron James generation, still going to Air Jordan for his references. And if Burmeister's stepping aside, what about the next generation of Iditarod mushers? Well, still mushing as the top rookie in this year's race, we have Hanna Lyrik, the 22-year-old Norwegian, who is the youngest musher in the field. She's out of White Mountain and in 20th position. And who's that in 19th, just a minute ahead of Lyrik? Why, it's Paige Drobny, who cracked into the top 10 a couple of years ago, finishing 7th in both 2019 and 2020. That's not happening this year, but Drobny, certainly an accomplished Iditarod and Yukon Quest musher. Lyrik has been right with Drobny ever since Shaktulik at race mile 754 and the last checkpoint before mushers head out onto the frozen Norton Sound. At the next checkpoint in Koyuk, Lyrik said mushing with Drobny was making her feel more comfortable about being out on that sea ice. Here is Lyrik in a clip, again, courtesy of Iditarod.com.
It's been really fun, and I'm super thankful for traveling with her. I feel pretty safe, especially going across the sea ice.
That is just really cool. Veteran musher Paige Drobny helping the Norwegian Hanna Lyrik in her first Iditarod. I didn't see this for myself, but apparently there was an Iditarod video that showed Drobny talking about this and how Lyrik had been nervous about falling into the open ocean, somewhere out there beyond the edge of the ice. So Paige told her that they would just travel together. Pretty cool. And they have continued to travel together. Looking at the tracker, Drobny and Lyrik mushed right next to each other from Koyuk to Elam, on to White Mountain, where, like I said, they left 1 minute apart. As I'm recording this, on their way to Nome still. So it looks like we're witnessing a new friendship on the Iditarod. How sweet. A sisterhood, if you will. And that brings me to our listener question. See how I did that?
Hi, this is Hannah.
And Olivia.
And we're sisters, and we work together sewing. And we listen to the Iditapod avidly while we're working. And
we heard your call for compliments, and we just want to say we love your show, and it keeps us motivated every day.
And so we have a question that we wanted to ask. Today we saw Mitch Seavey's team come into Ruby, and it looked like some of the dogs were wearing some kind of like plastic covering over their back ends. It almost looked like plastic duct taped onto their backs, and we were curious if you could let us know what that's all about.
Thank you.
Thanks for that question, Hannah and Olivia, and of course, thanks for the kind words. And we've got segues upon segues today. To get an answer, I'm calling Paige's husband, actually. He's also a dog musher, and her kennel partner, Cody Straith. Let's dial him up.
Hello.
Hey, Cody, it's Casey.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Good. Yeah, I just ate some great breakfast. So I'm fat and happy.
it's a pretty standard question, actually, in radio to try to get your levels right, to ask somebody what they had for breakfast. So what did you have?
I had the sweet stuffed waffle with bacon and fruit. It was pretty good.
Nice. I just had some instant macaroni and cheese, so.
Oh, yeah. That sounds good.
you're winning that part of the Iditarod. Anyway.
Good.
And this has been a snack attack with Cody and Casey. All right. So I called you because we got a listener question from a couple sisters, actually, who noticed one of the teams at one of the checkpoints farther back down the trail had these coverings on them. The dogs had coverings on them. Why would dogs have those coverings on them? What are those?
Well, there's quite a few different things that we put on the dogs to protect them. If it was at a checkpoint, it's possible that they not only had coats on that they can run in or sleep in, but sometimes we throw throw blankets over the dogs. So we'll actually put a little fleece blanket on top of the dog while they're sleeping, give them a little more insulation, protect them from snowfall and stuff like that. But when it's really windy, we protect them with a lot of different, or really cold, we protect them with a lot of different gear to make sure they don't get frostbite and they keep their body temperature right. And so a lot of times they've got running jackets on, which have little flaps to protect their flanks. They've got little thin areas of skin with not a lot of hair on their flanks, so you don't want to get frostbite there. The coats protect that, protect their under their bellies, you know. So they've got coats to protect their bellies. For the males, we want to protect their genitals, so there's a little flap that hangs down and catches the wind and covers that. Sometimes we'll actually put fur on the dogs as well, kind of like a fur ruff on my coat keeps my face from getting frostbite. We can put little fur ruffs around the bellies of the dogs to protect any bare spots or genital areas that don't want to get frostbitten. So we try to make sure the dogs are fully covered in that way. Sometimes you'll see some things on their front legs, kind of like the doggy version of chaps that riders wear on horses. We put these little leggings on the dogs, and that protects them. If the snow conditions are right, it can rip up the hair on their legs, and so we put those on to help protect their legs. Anytime there's like bare skin or really bad wind, we try to protect the dogs.
And is that kind of because the dogs, the modern Alaskan Husky, doesn't have as thick of a coat as maybe the old school dogs used to have?
It depends. I mean, there are certain genetics that have really good coats. You look at Brent's dogs, he's got great coats. A lot of our dogs have really good coats. But there are some other genetics that have more the European hounds, German short hairs, different things mixed in. And so their coats aren't as good. And in those cases, you definitely need to cover them. But the other thing that's different than the old dogs is in the freighting dogs, is they were only doing like 20 miles a day. And their hair was on their legs would hold up to those conditions for those short miles, and we're doing 100 miles a day. So if you think about that, there's a lot more possible wear and tear on the dogs. And so we try to protect them from those things.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Hey, while I've got you, I guess you're in Nome right now waiting for Paige to come in, and I'm sure very excited and looking forward to seeing her. One thing we've noticed and we've talked about on the podcast today is how she's been traveling with that Norwegian rookie, Hanna Lyrik. And I just thought I'd ask, what do you think about that?
It seems like since about Shaq Tulik, they kind of joined forces. It can be really lonely out there, depending on your mental state. If things aren't going well, it's nice to have somebody around that you can chat with, that you get along with. There's lots of people out there, and sometimes you don't want to be around certain people, but if there's a pleasant person around with a good attitude, it's nice to have some positive energy around. And I don't know Hannah, but I met her at the start, and she seems like a happy person. I met her parents here in Nome. They all seem really happy, so I'm sure that's helping Paige's attitude to have a nice, happy person around that's also got a good dog team and has some skills. And so going out across the sea ice can be a scary thing if you're out there alone, especially in a windstorm. And so that's when they got together. I haven't talked to her about that since they've joined forces, but I'm sure that just helped them both kind of be a little more confident in the crossings and the wind. I think they're having a good time. I don't know. I haven't heard.
Yeah. It looks cool just watching the tracker of them right next to each other, like buddies, you know? I guess I wonder, and maybe I'll kind of sound like a jerk asking this question, but Paige like broke into the top 10 a couple years ago. She's had 2 seventh place finishes. And obviously that's not happening this year. We've seen a bunch of mushers come in already, but why would she hang back if she is with a rookie musher in this race? I mean, if she could potentially be up farther.
So there's a couple things that happened this year. There's always a million excuses and a million things that happen. Our 2 main leaders, Turkey and Nico, that have been our main race leaders for years. They kind of the ones that always bring us to Nome or the finish of the quest. They both couldn't come. Nico had a sore shoulder the week before suddenly, and then Turkey had a bad ECG on his heart and wasn't allowed to come. And so that was really sad. The 2 main leaders weren't here. And so she didn't have as much confidence in the young group of dogs that she had. She had a lot of veterans, but the leaders hadn't really been to know them yet. So she didn't have a lot of confidence in that. And then they got a little bit sick early and didn't eat very well. And so she ended up with a much smaller team pretty early on than she wanted. And so from what I can understand from the couple times I got messages from her, she just was feeling like she just needed to slow down and make sure that she showed up in Nome with happy dogs. And so that's kind of been her goal for the last several hundred miles, is just to bring them in and try to have a good time at the end. She really wanted to be in the top 10, and we have dogs that could get her there, but just circumstances didn't go that way this year, and that's just part of racing.
Yeah, no doubt. We've talked about that and how many different things can happen, and it makes sense that just for the safety of the dogs and, you know, the team that she's got, that would be the case. So.
Yeah,
makes sense. And those are your dogs too, we should say, with that Squid Acres kennel and dog sled tours. You guys used to be based in Esther, but you're now in Cantwell, is that right?
Yeah, we're in Cantwell now. We have a cabin in Cantwell, and we do some dog mushing tours out of Cantwell. And then we recently bought the old Susitna Lodge out in Milton Ollie Highway, and we're rebuilding that place and opening that up as kind of a high-end adventure lodge with dog mushing tours and all kinds of adventure stuff. So. Yeah, we love it down there. It's nice to be in the mountains, and Fairbanks is still our hometown when we got to go grocery shopping and stuff, but it's nice to be down in the mountains.
As a former resident of Esther, I'm like required to say Esther any chance
Esther,
I get. Is
that a Fairbanks?
That's what my dad would do, you know. Well, thanks for answering these questions for me, Cody. A couple of questions just from me, but I have one more for you. And
Okay. It's
because I just want to make sure I get this right. I feel like maybe I've been saying Paige's last name wrong. I've been saying Paige Drobny.
Yeah. She goes by Drobny. You have been messing up a lot, and we've been meaning to talk to you about that, but we'll let it slide.
All right. I won't get it wrong now, so I appreciate you filling me in. We've got a few other little corrections to make on the podcast, but definitely appreciate you being on and for sharing.
I got a question for you.
Sure.
How do you say Dan Caduce?
Oh no! Have we been getting that wrong too?
No, I'm kidding.
Is it like Cody Strathe, like that?
Yeah, like that.
You just need to put the accent on there, you know.
Yeah. Totally.
Well, cool, man. Thanks for filling me in. I appreciate it. We'll have to come see you up on the Denali Highway someday.
Sounds good. Great talking to Casey.
You too. Thanks.
Yep.
Bye. Thank you for that, Mr. Cody Strathe. That also helps me address a name pronunciation correction that I've been getting wrong. Sorry about that. How about a couple more corrections while I'm at it? I think in a previous episode, we said that last year's Iditarod went from Willow to the ghost town of Flat. That was not true, but it had been the plan for that race originally. There had just been too much snow for the trail breakers to make it too flat, and the race actually turned around at a different ghost town, the old mining town of Iditarod. Sort of the namesake for the trail. Also, I think I said in the last episode that after Sass and CV, there were 44 mushers still on the trail. There were actually 42 other mushers still out on the trail after the five scratches, and those two had finished. And that brings us to, let's see, carry the one divided by cross the T, dot the lowercase j. Oh yeah, 49 mushers started the race. So in case you were questioning my math, you were right, and I was wrong, and I am bad at math. All right, I feel like we really got to a lot of Hannahs today, or Hannahs. And that's going to wrap it up for the Iditapod. This will now be known as the Hannapod, the Hananapod, maybe? Seriously, though, this 10th episode of Season 6 of the Iditapod will be our last. Our reporters out on the trail, Jeff Chen and Lex Trinan, are headed home after nearly two straight weeks of race coverage. We'll still have that one more bonus episode, that extended interview with 2022 Iditarod champ Brent Sass, coming up in your podcast feeds. But yeah, it's always a little sad to have to put the Iditapod to bed for the season. Definitely a lot of stories still to tell from the mushers continuing to make their way to Nome. We talked quite a bit before the race about Jeff King hopping onto Nick Petit's sled and mushing Petit's team after Petit tested positive for COVID and had to withdraw right before the race. We had a listener question about that, but it just hasn't worked out so far for us to catch up with King about how the race has gone and what had been a dog team that he was pretty unfamiliar with. Also, we're still hoping to talk to Matt Fahler about having to shoot a moose near Galena. That's got to be a wild story. But we're going to keep our eyes and our ears open for more tales from the trail from King, Fahler, and anybody else. And if we hear anything, we'll try to post updates at alaskapublic.org. As always, that's where you'll find our stories, photos, including the dogs of the day, those videos Brent Sass sent us, and a whole lot more. That's really the hub for all of the stories our intrepid public radio reporters all over Alaska are producing every day. So if you want to get to know Alaska better, whether you're outside the state or you live here, check it out. Also, if you want to help us keep Iditapodding and keep public media thriving in Alaska, please consider making a donation at alaskapublic.org or even becoming a member. Donations and sponsorships are how we fund this whole operation, so if you value what we do, consider throwing some dollars our way. That'll certainly help us bring back the Iditapod next year and to get us out on the trail again, from Anchorage to Willow, all the way to Nome. And with that, although it is bittersweet, we have got to go. Thank you so much for all the kind words. Everybody that's reached out and told us how much they appreciate this podcast has really been the thing that's made it worth doing. At the end of the day, when we're tired, it just feels so good to hear from you. So we appreciate your support, and please keep in touch. That theme music is Forever and Always by the band Sassafras. Thanks to the rest of the Iditapod team, Tegan Hanlon, Lex Trinan, and Jeff Chen. Great work this year, you guys. It was a pleasure to work with you. Thanks again to all you fine folks for listening. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, next year, I guess, happy trails.
And are you having fun today?
Yeah.
What's your favorite part about all of this?
The doggies.
That's a good answer. What do you like about dogs?
Because they're so soft.
Also a good answer.